So if you've been with us in the book of John, we're in John chapter 5. And last week I did a more of a topical study on the issue of pain and suffering and what the biblical answer for that is. And we went over two of Jesus' major healings, the healing of a nobleman's son and the healing of a man who is crippled in front of a pool in Bethesda, which is kind of near Jerusalem. Now, this leads into one of the longest theological sections in the Gospels. John is actually the most theological Gospel that there is. He has more discussions on the nature of God and the nature of Jesus and who he is compared to God than any other Gospel writer, which is kind of interesting to us because we tend to think of John as like, man, he's the love guy, you know, 1 John, the love book, you know, and he was reclining on Jesus' bosom and, you know, they were hanging, you know, he's not really the Oxford scholar kind of dude that we would imagine. But he definitely sees the need for this. And so before we get into the study, I wanted to talk a little about theology. So Tom, if you would, I have a PowerPoint, very short, but we're going to talk a little about theology, and we're going to be talking a lot about what theology means, the importance of it, and the nature of the relationship between Jesus and the Father, because that's what John 5 is about, is Jesus and the Father and their relationship together, and why it's important that we understand these things. So theology is the study of the nature of God. That's what it is. That's the definition. So when we're talking about the study of the nature of God, the immediate question that most people in our culture would ask is, can God actually be known? And a lot of people might say something, this might sound familiar to you guys, they might say something like this: I believe in a God who is greater than the pages of the Bible. Have any of you guys heard something similar to that before in your lives? I believe in a God who's greater than the pages of the Bible. And what they really mean, and this is very, very popular, they'll bring up this story of, you know, the multiple blind men encountering an elephant. And, you know, one of them, you see, he's touching the tusk and he's saying it's a spear. And the other one, he's grabbing the trunk and he's saying, oh no, the elephant's like a snake. And one of them, he's touching the side, he's like, no, it's like a wall. And you know, the one on the back, he's in its butt and he's like, man, it's like a rope, you know, and that's what it is. And so they're all kind of like, what someone would say who says, I believe in a God who's greater than the pages of the Bible, is they say, I think all religions are grasping at the truth of God. And I think all of them understand a part of God, but no one has the full truth. That's really what they're trying to say when they say that I believe in a God greater than the pages of the Bible. Does that make sense to you guys? Now, there's a couple of things wrong with this. There's a couple of things wrong with this analogy. The first thing that's wrong with this analogy is usually when people give this analogy, what they're using it as an attack against what you believe. They're using it to say, how can you be so arrogant to think that you understand God? Does that make sense? They're saying that you're being arrogant, you're being prideful. How could you possibly say that you understand God? He's so big and massive. How can you say that? When in reality, by using this example, it's actually the most arrogant claim that you could possibly make. Think about it this way. This picture is funny to us because we can see, right? If we were blind, we would be listening to these guys and be like, I actually don't know who's right. Maybe an elephant is like a spear. I don't really know. You see, the only way that I can know that every single person is wrong is if I can actually see the truth. Does that make sense? So by someone pointing at you and saying, you're being so arrogant because you think you know God, and they use this analogy, you know what they're actually putting themselves in the position of? The person who sees the truth. They're saying, you're like the blind person, and I'm like the person who sees the reality. Do you see how that's an arrogant claim? So in reality, by saying that I'm not being arrogant, I'm actually making the most arrogant claim I could possibly make, and saying everybody's wrong but me. And that's obviously kind of foolish. The other problem with this analogy is, again, we being people who can see, just because these people are feeling around the elephant trying to figure out truth, doesn't mean that the elephant can't be known or understood. Does that make sense? Any one of these people could actually figure out the full nature of an elephant by feeling around and talking to other people who are also trying to figure out the elephant. And that's really what theology is. Theology is studying God, utilizing the concrete evidence that we have that he has given us about himself, and discussing it among other people who have studied the subject as well, so that we can come to an actual understanding of God. Because God can be understood. That's what the Bible teaches. See, the person of Jesus Christ reveals to us that God is an understandable God. Right? It says in John 1, verse 18, "No one has seen God at any time, but the only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has revealed him to us." Right? So Jesus came to show us that the Father, that God, can be understood. He can be known. It's nothing that we can say, hey, you know, God is beyond understanding. God can be understood to an extent. Now, we as Christians, we don't say that we can know fully who God is this side of heaven, because we do admit we are like the blind men grasping at the elephant. We don't have full sight yet. One day we will see God face to face, and then it will be like looking at him. But right now, what we're doing is we're just using the information that he's given us and trying to figure out more and more what he is like. Does that make sense to you guys? So that's what theology is. And here's the importance of theology. You can go to the next slide. The importance of theology. And I'm going to use two examples, relating and knowing. A lot of people think, I don't really need theology. I don't really need theology because I relate to God. Right? I've experienced God. I understand him. I hang out with him. You know, I have a lot of buddies who became foxhole converts in Afghanistan. All right, and they had probably experiences with God, probably very emotional experiences with God. And they would say, man, I don't need to. I mean, this whole idea of theology, it's so heady and weird. I feel like by learning theology, I'd be taking a step away from the true God. I don't know if any of you guys have ever thought that way, where you're like, man, you know, I don't really like the topic of theology. I don't really like getting into this whole heady knowledge. I would rather just relate to Jesus. I mean, he's a person. Let's just relate to the guy. Now, here's the problem with that. Think about if I treated a physical relationship that way. I was like, you know what? I have so much fun with my wife, and she's so awesome, and I like spending time with her. I really don't need to get to know her at all. You know, that just seems so heady to me, and who really cares where she was born or what her last name is or, you know, what her favorite color is or what her movies that she likes. I don't really need to know any of that because I just enjoy her. Would that work? No, that would be an incredibly shallow and horrible relationship. And so as a Christian, and I'm hoping this challenges you guys, the book of John was written to challenge you no matter where you are in life. Okay, because there really are two types of people. There are people who are really good at theology, but they suck at the relationship part with God. Guess which one I am. And the other group of people are really good at relating to God, but they really suck at the theology part. Right? And the fact that you guys are laughing tells me that you know which one I am. I suck at the relating part. So there's dangers in both, and that's why God checks both of us. All right, so I'm hoping that tonight, if you're a person who's just related to God, but you've never given any credence to theology, I hope that this will be a challenging time for you. So it develops you in more areas of your relationship with God. And those of you guys who are more theologically minded, I do hope that this is going to be an edifying time for you, but that you are also challenged by the other parts of John that do portray Jesus as more of a personal being that you can relate to. And that you're challenged by that and you desire to learn to be more personal with him. And here's an example that C.S. Lewis gave in his book, Mere Christianity. You want to click again, Tom. He said, relating to God is like spending time on the beach. Okay, it's like relating to the ocean. You know, I hang out on the beach. I get to see the waves. I see the power of the waves. I get to feel the water. You know, I get to smell the ocean, and it's beautiful. And it's amazing. And knowing God, meaning theology, is like a map. If you want to hit again, it's like a map. Okay, now here's the problem with just relating to God. Here's the problem with just relating to God. If all you're doing is walking along the beach of the Atlantic Ocean, you'll never understand the width and length and depth of that thing. You'll never understand exactly where it goes. You'll never understand exactly how to get from point A to B. You'll never understand actually what it's like. Does that make sense? Your understanding of it will be very limited, even though you are experiencing it. The danger of just studying theology is that your relationship with God is not really a relationship at all. It's like an intellectual pursuit. It's like, you know, I could stare at the map of the Atlantic Ocean all day long, but I'm never going to understand exactly the beauty and the splendor that's in the Atlantic Ocean. Does that make sense? I'm never actually going to be able to experience it. And so some people study God like he's a subject at school. They study him like he's a subject at school. So they have a lot of knowledge about him, but they don't know how to relate to him at all. And a lot of people relate to him so much that they actually don't know him at all. We want to be balanced. John Piper put it this way. He says, a relationship with God is like playing, bowling, where it has the wussy lanes up, you know, whatever those things are called, the bumpers, you know, for the people who aren't good like I am. I'm actually terrible at bowling. So, you know, they have the things, and he says, one side is like knowledge, and the other side is like emotionality. And he says, whenever you get too far to knowledge, God will bounce you back towards emotionality. And if you get too far on emotionality, he'll bounce it back towards knowledge. Because he wants to make you whole. He wants to make you complete. He wants to give you a well-rounded experience with him. Does that make sense to you guys? All right, let's go to the next slide. So what we're going to talk about tonight specifically is, like I said, we're going to be talking about Jesus' relationship to his Father. Okay, we as Christians, we believe that Jesus is God. The Father is God, the Holy Spirit is God, yet there is only one God. Okay, and that is a very complicated thing. And I understand a lot of you are just like, man, the Trinity, that sounds really complicated. I'm not even going to look into it. But it actually is important to look into it. If it wasn't important, then the Bible wouldn't have so many sections on it. In fact, John 5, as we're going to get into this whole last section from John 5, verse 16 to the end of the chapter is all Jesus explaining his relationship to the Father. And this is not the only time in this book that he's going to do it. It's very important that we understand Jesus' nature and his relationship to his Father. It's very important that we grab this. And one of the major reasons why we need to understand this is because God is something that C.S. Lewis called beyond personality. Now, if you talk to someone who's a Buddhist or a Hindu, even a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon, when they say the words God is beyond personality, really what they mean is that God is not personal at all. If you really get down to talking to a Hindu about what their version of God is, they're like, God is like an ocean. Man, we're all droplets. And as we become more enlightened, we all engage with the ocean. All right? So what's their view of God? Is he a personal God? No, he's like more like a force. He's more like just an entity. He's not personal at all. He's not relatable at all. You can't relate to the ocean. You can't talk to the ocean. You can't do anything about the ocean. It's just the ocean. It's a brute fact. And again, even if you talk to Jehovah's Witnesses and things like that, or Muslims, you'll get very clearly that their view of God is that of a very impersonal deity. Someone who's just up and he creates all things and he's just kind of looking down impassively at his creation. He doesn't really care or have emotion towards it. Whereas when the Bible says that God is beyond personality, it actually means that he is more personal than you and I ever could be. And the reason why he's able to do that is because he has three persons and is one being. All right, so let's talk about how that could be possible. All right, let's think about dimensions for a second. I know you guys are just rearing for this study. Let's think about dimensions, okay? If I have one dimension of space, those of you guys who are in school, what does that mean? If I have one dimension of space, what do I have? I have a line, right? You have the x-axis, right? So Tom, you want to put that up? So if I have one dimension of space, this is what I have. I have a line. I could only move in a straight line. So if I was a being in a one-dimensional universe, all I could see is straight ahead. That's it. I could only move forward or backwards. I couldn't move left or right. And I certainly couldn't move up or down. I have no concept of that. Okay? When you move into two dimensions, you get left and right. You get the y-axis. All right? And that's where you could start making shapes, like squares and circles and things like that. Okay? Now, when you move into three dimensions, you get depth. And that's where you get objects like cubes or spheres. Okay? So cubes or spheres. Now, if you look at this cube, it has six squares in it. Correct? It has six squares in it, yet it remains one object. Now, do a thought experiment with me right now. Try, in your own minds right now, try to explain a cube to someone who only lives in a two-dimensional world. What kind of words would you use with that person? Right? If I was talking to two-dimensional Peter, whatever, and I was like, hey, man, like, there's distance. I might be like, okay, there's this object and it's like a square. And he's like, oh, I understand a square. Yeah, I see those. and times six, and you might be like, wait, but if I have six squares, then it's just six separate squares. Be like, no, they're together. You'd be like, okay, well, if I stack six squares on together, it's still just six squares. It's still, does that make sense? It wouldn't make any sense to him. The best I could do with him is be like, hey, you just got to trust that I understand something that you don't. All right? A more accurate statement would be a cube has six squares, meaning there are six squares within a cube. Six squares don't necessarily make up a cube, though. Does that make sense? I could stack six squares onto each other, and it's not a cube. It's only a cube when it's aligned in a very specific format, and then it becomes a cube. When we get to God, we're dealing with something completely beyond our understanding. We experience three dimensions of time and space. Scientists have theorized there's anywhere between 10 and 100 dimensions of time and space. Okay? So when God tells me, hey, I'm three persons but one being, I'd be like, wait, that can't be. If you take three persons, I take you three, you're three separate people. No matter how I put you guys together, you're still three people. No matter how I sort you out, no matter how I try to figure out my mind, you are still three separate people. Then I might be like, okay, well, maybe it's like a split personality. You know, maybe it's like Jerry, but he's also Bob and Terry, you know, and he's all three, you know, so it's one being, but it's three persons. But that still doesn't work. It still doesn't work because his mind is divided. See, he's not fully three persons. He's one third of a personality. Does that make sense? Those three personalities actually make up one functioning being. God's not like that. God is three full persons in one being. So what do I have to do as a Christian? I have to accept this on faith. I don't understand it fully, but God has expressed this to me, and so I trust it. But honestly, this is one of the major reasons why I actually, ironically, believe in Christianity. All the other gods and goddesses that I've read about, whether they're in pagan mythology or even in the modern-day religions that we are aware of, their versions of God are very simple. They're things that I can understand. I don't need to study theology to figure out Zeus. He's a very simple guy, right? Lives on Mount Olympus, right? He controls lightning and thunder. He sometimes transforms into bulls to have sex with girls, right? He does a lot of weird things. I understand that guy. He's very simple. I understand Allah. Very simple. He's just like me, really. He gets upset, he gets angry, he gets sad. See, he doesn't really have anything complex about him or beyond my understanding. What sense does it make for a man-made religion to create a God that you can't understand? Does that make sense? That would be ridiculous. If I'm making up a religion, I'm certainly going to make up a God that people could easily understand because that's palatable. The only reason that I could possibly conceive of that the early Christians and the Jews as well created a God who is complex in his unity that is beyond human understanding is because God really is complex in his unity and beyond my human understanding. Now, there are a couple things in nature to help me understand this unity of God. If you want to click on the next one, I picked two of the most powerful. First one is the sun. Okay, because Jesus, in this section, he's going to describe his relationship with the Father, and I hope this doesn't go over you guys' heads. If there's two gods, we have what we call in philosophy an omnipotence paradox. Okay? What that means is that we all believe that God is omnipotent. You guys know what that means? It means he's all-powerful. Now, here's where the paradox comes in. If I have two gods who are both all-powerful, neither one is all-powerful. Because whatever this God does, this God can undo. Does that make sense? If there remains two beings who are equal in power, neither one is all-powerful because they could always undo or cancel out what the other one has done. All right. So if we have three persons of God who are all fully God, we have an omnipotence paradox. Okay, something that cannot be logically reasoned out. The only way that the Trinity works is if the three personalities of God submit to one another so that the Son willingly receives his source from the Father and does everything that the Father says. If the Son had a will that contradicted the Father, God is no longer omnipotent. It's only when he functions as one singular being that it works. Does that make sense to you guys? Here's an example, the Son. When we look at the Son, I hope you guys know, you're not actually looking at the Son. You're looking at hundreds of millions of explosions that are happening on the surface of the sun. The actual sun that is the source for all that light is the core. That's what the actual sun is. What you're seeing is you're seeing the reflection of the core. You're seeing the outpouring, the power of the core of the sun. Does that make sense? Now, if I were to look at the sun, I would be like, okay, well, the surface of the sun gets its source from the center of the sun. So which one's greater? They're the same. Could one exist without the other? No, you take away the core, obviously the rays go away. You take away the rays, obviously the core has no power. One could not exist without the other. So when we're talking about Jesus, you need to understand that. Just because Jesus receives the source, his source from the power, from God the Father, doesn't make him lesser than God the Father, and it doesn't insinuate that he was created at some point. It just means that that's how God is. Here's another example. You. When I look at you, when I look at Thomas, I'm actually not looking at Thomas. I'm looking at his body. Now, his body is not really him. And just to prove that, if I were to take out Thomas's brain and I were to place it with Jerry's brain, is it still Thomas? No, it's Jerry, right? We've all seen Freaky Friday. All right, so it's not the same person anymore. I've completely changed the person of Thomas by changing his brain. You see, what I'm looking at is I'm looking at the expression or the outflowing of Thomas's brain. Does that make sense to you guys? So it would be accurate for me to say that, again, you guys aren't looking at me, but my body receives its source from my mind. My body receives its source from my mind. Does it make my mind greater than my body or my body greater than my mind? No, they're equal. This is just how I am as a human being. That's how I express myself. There is no other way that I could operate or live. All right? So with God, it's the same way. The Son, he receives a source from the Father, and also his job is to make the Father known. So if you're ever reading in the Old Testament, in places like Isaiah chapter 6, Genesis 18, where people encounter God, they see God, they touch him, they talk to him, they listen to him. These parts where they're talking to God, they're not actually talking to the source, a.k.a. the Father. They're talking to the Son, the one who makes the Father known. Now imagine for one second, what if your brain and your body were two separate persons? Could you imagine that? What if your brain and your body were two separate persons? Let's call my brain Bob, and my body is Peter. Now, as Peter, I could say, I willingly submit to Bob. And I don't do anything of myself. It is Bob who does for me. And I do not do anything of my own volition, but it is only the things that Bob shows me to do. See, that would sound very weird to you guys, but in that scenario, that's very accurate. All right, so as we're studying the words that Jesus is about to say, I hope that helps you guys kind of understand what he's saying. That he's not trying to say that he's lesser than God. He's not trying to say that he's a different God. He's actually saying that he is fully God in a way that we don't fully understand. All right, let's move on. Let's go to John chapter 5, verse 19. That's where we're going to be. 16, sorry. And one thing that I do want to touch on really quickly, as we finish up our study of suffering, one of the things that suffering does is it reveals to us our false conceptions of God and our false idols that are inside of our lives. Here's what I mean. If something gets taken away from me and I'm hurting, I'm in pain. Like, for instance, if I was driving home tonight and I wrecked my car, that would hurt, right? Not only physically, but emotionally, because I like that car. You know, it's my car. I don't want it to be wrecked. Right, it would hurt me emotionally. But it certainly wouldn't crush me. Does that make sense? I would be okay. If you guys saw me 2 weeks from then, and you're like, hey, Peter, how are you doing? And I'm just like crying. I'm like, I don't know what to do. I've lost the will to live. You'd be like, I think you were a little bit too into your car. You know, I think you like that thing a little bit more than what was healthy. What that would reveal in my life as I lost the will and desire to live, what that would reveal in my life is I have misunderstood God. I have placed something before God that I shouldn't have done. I've idolized something in my life. Does that make sense? I've put an improper relationship inside of my life before God. Now, in that moment of suffering, you have this unique opportunity to gain knowledge of the true and living God. You see, you can only gain knowledge of the true and living God when you understand that your version of Him is wrong. As long as you think that, and all, let's be real, in our hearts, we all think that we know God. I know God. I understand God. You know, my version of Him is perfect. You know, you think that in your heart. You may not say that out loud, especially not after I just said that. But you may not say that out loud. But deep down somewhere in your prideful, sinful soul, you believe that. And as long as you believe that, you will never seek to understand Jesus in a different way. It's only when you're brought to a moment of your life where you lose heart, where you recognize, I don't see God right. If I would have seen God right, I wouldn't have done what I just did. I wouldn't have lost heart if I saw God right. It's only in that moment in your life do you have the opportunity to truly gain wisdom of who God truly is. That's why I think it is so significant that this section is right there after the section on healing. So let's start with John 5, verse 16, though. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill Him, because He had done these things on the Sabbath. Now, in the other Gospels, if you guys have had any experience with them, you know this happened often. Jesus just loved healing people on the Sabbath to prove a point. All right, because the Sabbath, those of you guys who don't know, it was celebrated from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday for the Jews. And even observant Jews to this day, and Seventh-day Adventists, they celebrate the Sabbath. And they keep it holy. Okay, and it was a day that God gave them in their law, and He says, you have to keep it. You have to keep this thing. Now, later on in the New Testament, we realize the purpose of the Sabbath was to show us the true rest that we have in Jesus Christ. That He's given us a rest from work. That by faith alone in Him, we are sanctified and justified before God. That there's no more works involved. That God just loves me. Does that make sense? The Sabbath was a picture. But for the Jews, the Sabbath was a very serious thing. They had to keep it in order to keep the law. They had to do this. And Jesus, His point in the other Gospels, I'm not going to go into it because this is not going to be John's point. This is the point of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Jesus responded to them and said, it's better to do good things on the Sabbath than evil things. Meaning, if someone came up to me on the Sabbath day, a day where I'm supposed to rest and not do any work, and they're dying of thirst, and they said, sir, you know, I need a cup of water. I'm like, whoa, it's the Sabbath. You know, I can't work, man. You're asking me to sin right now. Obviously, you wouldn't do that. Obviously, you would help them out. And that's what Jesus' point was. All right, these people are hurting. I'm not working for my own benefit or pleasure. I'm working to help these people because I love them and I care about them. Man was not made for the Sabbath, but Sabbath was made for man. It was supposed to be a blessing for people. But let's see how John takes this, though. So he doesn't reiterate this because he's the final gospel that's written. So he wants to go in a different direction. Let's see how Jesus answers it this time. Verse 17. But Jesus answered them, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill Him, because He not only broke the Sabbath, but He also said that God was His Father, making Himself equal with God. Now, this is something that we don't understand. All right, sons of God is something that we're just like, so what? You know, I'm a son of God. You know, He's got sons by the tons, as the Islamic people say. You know, I mean, what's the big deal? He says that He's the Son of God. It's because you're, no offense, you're in a Western society. You're reading this from a Western perspective. For a Jew, and they're more logical about this than we are, for a Jew to say that you're the son of somebody means that you're going to be like them. Here's what I mean by that. There's a very big difference. We've read earlier in this book, you guys probably all know, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that He sent His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him shall not perish but have everlasting life. Jesus is called the begotten Son of God. Right? Now, there's a difference between God making something and God begetting something. In the Bible, God makes all things. But in the Bible, He only begets one person. Why? Think about it. If I make a statue, the statue is different than me, correct? If I beget a son, that son will grow up to be a man just like me. He is in my same species. Does that make sense? So if duck begets duck, ape begets ape, man begets man, God begets God. By Jesus saying that God is my Father, what He's saying is, I am God. I am of the same essence as God. Does that make sense to you guys? Now, notice also how he answers the question. We miss this sometimes. This is still in verse 17. But notice how he answers the question. We miss this sometimes. Here's his excuse for working on the Sabbath. This is what he says. My father has been working until now, and I've been working. Here's his excuse. Don't use this excuse, by the way. All right? People are coming up to him and be like, Jesus, you're working on the Sabbath. He says, so what? God still works on the Sabbath. Is that a weird way to answer that question? What an odd way to answer that question. Hey, you don't expect God to stop spinning the planets on their axis and, you know, providing light for us and healing people. You don't expect God to do that. So what's wrong if I do it? What if I gave you guys the answer for something? Peter, you can't forgive sin. God forgives sin. Is that a blasphemous thing to say or what? But God forgives sin. Peter, you're glorifying yourself. You're making it all about you. God glorifies himself. So what? You know? Do you guys understand just how audacious this sentence is that Jesus is saying to them? And this is something that I really love about Jesus. See, a lot of times when we're thinking about sharing our faith with people and things like that, we're always like, you know, the seeker-sensitive type people. We're like, man, you know, I can't offend people. I need to say, you know, things that they're going to be able to accept, and I need to be gentle with people. It seems to me that whenever Jesus was confronted, he always took it one step further. People are like, hey, you're sinning on the Sabbath. Hey, guess what? I'm God. You know, like he could have taken it a step back and be like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't know I offended you. Let me talk this through with you. He's like, oh, by the way, I'm also God. Wrap your mind around that one and then get away from me. You know, that's basically what he does. And it's just absolutely insane to me. All right. So let's keep going. So he takes it even more steps. You're like, okay, that's enough, Jesus. You know, you've claimed equality with God. You said you're the Son of God, making yourself equal with God. They're really pissed at you. You should probably take it a couple steps back. Nope. Verse 19, then Jesus answered and said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he sees the Father do. For whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner. So that's the example that I gave you guys of like the mind, right? The mind is the source of the body. So the Father is the source of the Son. So what's he saying? He's saying, I don't do anything except what the Father shows me. I'm not a separate God. I'm not a different God who can annul my Father's will. I am in concert with him. He shows me everything that I do when I do it. Now notice verse 20. For the Father loves his Son and shows him all things that he himself does, and he will show him greater works than these, that they may marvel. For as the Father raised the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son, that all should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father. Now he takes it like way above what they just had him with, right? He's like, hey, by the way, I could do these things because my Father does it. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm the Son of God. Oh, and by the way, I could do everything that my Father does. Did you guys catch that? He says, the Father has shown me all things and worship me. And he says, hey, and just as you honor the Father, you should honor me. That's crazy. That's absolutely insane. Any thinking person, any rational person going through John chapter 5 would have to understand that Jesus is making a claim to be God. A lot of us don't get it because we're like, and again, we're Western, we're white. We're like, man, why doesn't Jesus just say, I'm God? What's with all the cloak and dagger? You see, to say I am God in that culture was actually not what you and I think it would mean. First of all, to say I am God in that culture could mean that I am just a God in the sense of the angels are gods. Did you know that the same word that's used for God, Elohim, is used for the angels in the Old Testament? To say I am a God doesn't really mean a whole lot in their language. In fact, later on in John chapter 10, Jesus is going to say, doesn't the law say that you are gods? All right, so saying that you're God doesn't actually mean a whole lot. Secondly, even what it does mean would be improper. For Jesus to say, I am God, would for him to be saying, I am the Father. And that's not what we believe about him. Jesus is not the Father. And in fact, what he would actually be saying is this flesh that you see is God. He'd be making a man into God and God into a man, which is the worst possible sin that you could possibly do in the Old Testament. All right, so he has to say, I am the Son of God. All right, but his statements of his deity are much stronger than just simply saying, I am God. Next week, we're going to study his first I am statement. And that is radical. That is the most radical statement that Jesus makes about his deity. his belonging to the being and nature and essence of God, very God. All right, so once again, the question that we have to ask, though, is, okay, that's great, that's very heady, theological stuff. But why does that matter for me? What does that matter for me? Why do I have to know this? Right, this doesn't really seem like it applies to me very much. Here's why it applies to you. First of all, it helps you to know, first of all, that, again, God is a knowable being. So often in our lives, again, in the Christian church, we wouldn't say this out loud, but I know in your heart, because this is in my heart, there are many times in my life where I feel like God is unknowable. Or there are many times in my life where I bring in my own prejudice towards who God is, and I start making him how I'd like him to be. Now, just think about this. Do this just one moment. Think about the last time you majorly blew it. Last time you majorly sinned. If you're like me, you don't have to think back too far. All right? Now, when you think about the last time that you majorly blew it, think about how you felt that God thought about you. Now, again, if you're anything like me, the picture that I have of God in my mind right now is that of a disapproving father pointing his finger at me and saying, "Don't do that again." But is that who God actually is revealed in the Scriptures? No. Where did I get that image from? Was it from the Bible? No, I imported that image from what I understand of God. Does that make sense? I'm not submitting to the Bible. The Bible is submitting to me in that instance. So the reason why you need to study theology is so that you don't have wrong views of God inside of your head. You need to study the Bible and theology so it clears out your bad images and views of God so that you get a correct version of him. Here's another reason why it's so beautiful. Once again, one of the major problems that we have with God is we don't feel like he's relatable to us. We feel like he's so distant and weird and beyond understanding. How could I possibly know God? And here in this instance, in this very small interchange, what Jesus has said is, "I am fully God and I became like you. I'm fully God and I became like you. I became fragile. I became someone who could die. I became someone who could feel pain, misery, sadness." You see? And he became like you so that you could become like him. Let me pull up a couple of verses for you to show you what I mean. This is Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, and let's begin in verse 16. Okay, I think I have that one up there. "The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ." Isn't that crazy? "If indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified with him." Now, a lot of us don't want that last sentence in there. We're just like, yeah, I'm all about the inheritance, stuff like that. "If you suffer with him." Ugh, that sucks, you know? And I'll explain that one in a second. But here's what Paul is getting at. This is crazy, insane. He's saying Jesus became like you so that you could become like him, his brother. See, Jesus' death and his resurrection reveal to us that God has approved of humanity and that he will glorify you together with Jesus in his kingdom. You will be just as he is, without death, without pain, without misery. You'll be just like him in those ways. Now, obviously, there are certain ways that you can't be like God because God was obviously uncreated, and guess what? You are. So there are some ways that you can't be like God, but in every other way, you can be like him. Now, why is that important? You will only raise to the highest level that you see yourself. You will only raise to the highest level that you see yourself. Here's what I mean. If you think that you're stupid and that you will never, ever, ever understand math, guess what's going to happen? You're never, ever, ever going to understand math because you've already stated that that's who you are. You've already identified yourself. Does that make sense? If you sit in this room and you think, "I am a failure, I am a sinner, I am worthless, how could God love me?" That is the highest level that you ever raise to. You've already stated it. You've already identified yourself. But if instead of you seeing your identity being in your own hands, you instead see Jesus identified with me that I might identify with him. If instead you see and you start thinking, "I am, because of what he's done, I am going to be like him." How does that change the way I go about my daily life? How does that change the way I view my sin and how strong it seems in my life? How does that change the way that I deal with my struggles, my pain, my torment? Does that make sense? It radically alters the way that you view your entire life if you understand Jesus and the Father. If you don't understand Jesus and the Father, then you being identified with Jesus doesn't mean anything. It loses all meaning and definition. It only becomes powerful if you understand Jesus' relationship with the Father. Then it becomes beautiful. Then it becomes liberating. That the things that the Father has shown me, I will be able to do. That I've been delivered from death into new life. Does that make sense? Now let me explain that passage about suffering very quickly. This is Hebrews chapter 2, because I'm running out of time. Hebrews chapter 2 states this. Verse 10, "For it is fitting for him, Jesus, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, and bringing many sons into glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren." Now this is beautiful. Jesus calls you a brother. Jesus suffered though. And notice what it says. Jesus was made perfect through suffering. So that's the good news, bad news that's going on. Everything that you suffer through inside of your life has a purpose to make you more like Jesus. That's the bad news and the good news. But the more beautiful news is just as our Lord and Savior was made perfected through his sufferings, so your sufferings have a purpose to perfect you. Jesus suffered more than you and I ever will, but his sufferings had a purpose. You will suffer, but your sufferings have a purpose. See, it makes all the difference in the world when suffering has a purpose or not. Now, here's a great example. If I were to tell one of you guys, hey, you know, how about tomorrow you come to the church and I'm going to hit you in the chest really hard, like 50 times. That's going to hurt. You're going to be sore. But if I say to you, hey, why don't you come to the church tomorrow and we'll go work out. We'll do a bunch of push-ups and stuff like that. It's still going to hurt you. You're going to have a sore chest the next day. One suffering gives you something. The other suffering simply takes something away from you. Does that make sense? It makes all the difference in the world if your suffering has purpose. The only way you can see your suffering as having purpose, though, is if you have identified with Jesus. Just as Jesus fully trusted his Father inside of his suffering, because he knew my Father will never do anything that is against my betterment. So you can go through all sorts of pain and suffering, understanding the Father will never do anything that is not going to make me more like him. The Father's not going to do anything. He's not going to give anything into my life that I cannot handle or that won't purify me and make me more like him. See, it matters deeply how you understand Jesus. It matters deeply how you understand the Father. Imagine if you didn't have that understanding of Jesus and the Father, though. I've had a lot of people in my life tell me that the crucifixion of Jesus Christ is the number one thing that made them lose heart in God. They'll say things like, how can God the Father say that he's all-powerful when his son died and he couldn't even stop it? Now, obviously, the first thing I said to him is, do you understand the doctrine of Trinity? And when they say no, it's like, well, of course that's what you would see then. How could you not see an abusive father in the cross if you don't understand the Trinity? How could you not? How can you possibly trust the Father in your life to do what's best for you when he took his only son and objectified him to that? I'm sure you guys have seen the Passion of Christ. I'm sure you've read the gospel accounts and you've seen what happened to Jesus. If that's the way that God the Father treats his sons, I don't think I want to be one. You see, it's only when I understand that Jesus was fully God, willingly became a man, in line with the Father's will, that it broke the Father's heart to crucify his Son, but now he is sitting in eternal glory at the right hand of the Father, that his name is above every other name on this earth. See, that's when I see my suffering in the right context. See, it matters deeply what you understand about God, that you do understand theology. C.S. Lewis put it this way. He said that your whole being is like a mirror for God. And bad theology is like dust on that mirror. If you want a good reflection of God, you need to have that mirror clean. It means you have to have good theology. Every atrocity that has ever happened to mankind has come from a false reflection of God. I think God's like this. I think this is what I should act like. See, it's only when you understand the concrete nature of God that you understand concrete morals, values, and duty. So you need to understand these things. Now, verse 24, he says this, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, and shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life." He has brought this up several times inside of this book, but what makes me pass into everlasting life? What do I have to do? Believe. He doesn't say he who does all these things. He says he who believes. It's that simple. You believe in him, you receive his spirit, you become like him. That's as simple as it gets. Verse 25, "Most surely I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself, and has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in graves will hear this voice, and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me." There's so many things in there that I'd like to get into, but I don't have time tonight. I'm sure as we continue through this book, we're going to talk more and more about the idea of the resurrection, what it means. And certainly on the study that I'm going to be doing on Saturday, I'm going to get very deep into that and what the resurrection means for us. But notice what he says, those who have done good, and what is the good thing that we do? We believe in Jesus. Those who have done good, those who have believed in Jesus, those who have believed in the Father and the Word of the Father, you will receive the resurrection of life. You will be brought back and you will live with him forever. Those who have done evil, which is all of us, but have not believed in Jesus, they will be resurrected to a resurrection of condemnation. That's what we call hell. A lot of people will say that hell is like an oblivion. You just kind of go into nothingness and you lose consciousness. But clearly here, if you're being resurrected and you're going into condemnation, clearly that's a conscious thing. Clearly you have a sense of consciousness when you do that. Otherwise, you and I have no hope of having a consciousness when we go into eternal life, because he uses the same exact word. Now, a lot of us will struggle with this doctrine of hell. We'll struggle with this idea of hell. But I think Jesus answers it very well as we go through this a little further. So I'm not going to answer it now, but let's keep going. Verse 31, "If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. There is another who bears witness of me. And I know that the witness which he witnesses of me is true. You have sent to see to John." John was the prophet, John the Baptist, who came before Jesus to prophesy his coming. And he says this, "And he has borne witness of the truth. Yet I do not receive testimony from man, but I say these things that you may be saved. He was the burning and shining lamp, and you were willing for a time to rejoice in his light. But I have a greater witness than John's, for the works which the Father has given me to finish, the very work that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. And the Father himself who sent me has testified me. You have neither heard his voice at any time nor seen his form, but you do not have his word abiding in you, because whom he sent him you do not believe. You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they that testify of me, but you are not willing to come to me that you may have life." Jesus says, "I don't bear witness of myself." If someone bears witness of themselves, it's not valid. Look up any other religious leader that has ever happened inside of our world. Every single one of them bore witness of themselves. Every single one of them. How do I know that Joseph Smith is a prophet? Because he said he was. No one else prophesied of that guy. He said that he was the prophet, and so I'm just supposed to believe that. Who said that Muhammad is a prophet? Muhammad. Who said that Buddha is one of the Vedas that's going to lead us into eternal life? Buddha. Does that make sense? Every single one of these people just testified to themselves. They said, "You should believe me because you should believe me." Jesus is the only one who came on the scene and said, "You shouldn't believe me just because I say that." He says, there are three ways that you can know that I am actually, truly the Messiah. And this is the question I'm going to ask you guys tonight. It's not enough to just say, "I believe in Christianity because it seems right to me," which is something that this culture would be very good about saying, right? There's no such thing as absolute truth. It just seems good to me. There's three things that you should do to see if Jesus really is the person that he says. The only reason why you should give your life to Jesus Christ is because you know he's true. Here are the three ways you could test him. Number one, testimony. Notice he brings up John. He says, John testifies of me. That is the number one way that you can know that Jesus is real. The testimony of those people who claim to know God becomes a testimony of Jesus Christ and his authenticity for what he says he is. Now, Jesus says, this is the weakest of the testimonies, though. This is the weakest. Why? There are people for every religion that testify of that religion. That doesn't give any credence to it. It gives a little credence to it, but doesn't give enough to become a definitive thing. What's the second one that he says? If you don't believe those people, believe the works that I do. Now, we're in an unfortunate position where we cannot prove the works that Jesus did. We don't know what he did. Okay, we have the testimony in the Gospels, but we have to take that on faith. But we do have one work, we do have one miracle that can be verified in history. You know what that is? The resurrection. This is why I'm going to spend 3 weeks talking about the resurrection. The resurrection is one of the ways that Jesus said you can know that he's legitimate. So if you've been a Christian for a while and you've ever thought like, well, you know, the resurrection is cool, but it's just something you take on faith. Not true. Jesus expected it to be something that you can test and either falsify or verify. And if you have done neither to it, you have not taken him up on his word. Now, the third way that we are to establish that Jesus is who he says he is through the word itself, through the Bible. Which means that I have to see, is the Bible reliable? Can I prove whether or not the Bible is reliable? Well, yes, I can. Multiple ways. I'm not going to get into all of them tonight, but I'm going to give you two. Here's the first way. The Bible is not a scientific book, but it makes scientific statements. If the Bible ever made a false scientific statement, I should reject it. Now, here's the beauty of the Bible. It's made quite a few scientific statements. It's made quite a few specific scientific statements, and every single one of them is true. For instance, in Genesis 1, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It says that the heavens and the earth, the universe, had a beginning. Now, believe it or not, up until 2003, that's pretty recent, up until 2003, that was debatable, whether or not the universe had a beginning. A lot of people debated it. They're like, I don't know. But ever since 2003, you can look this up, the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem was established, which proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the universe had a definitive beginning, establishing what Judeo-Christianity has been saying for the last 6,000 years. Now, how did they know that? They didn't do any scientific experiments. Abraham wasn't up on Mount Hor or whatever, like figuring it out. God just gave it to him by revelation. That's pretty impressive. Here's another way that you can know the Bible is true. The Bible makes a lot of prophetic statements. If any prophecy of the Bible does not come true, by the Bible's own standard in Deuteronomy 18, you should reject it. Here's a beautiful thing. The Bible's made a lot of prophetic statements. Every single one of them has either come true or looks like it's about to. No other religion can say that. You need to test and verify these things for yourself. In 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter says this. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. Here's how you can have absolute confidence that when Jesus says, you will have a resurrection life, you will be with me one day. You test him at his word. Do you have a living hope? It's one thing to have a hope with no substance, like me saying, I hope it rains tomorrow. That has no substance to it. Could happen, could not happen. Okay? A hope with no substance could be the most damaging thing that could ever happen to you. If you put your ultimate hope in something that doesn't have any substance and it gets taken away from you, that is the most devastating event that could ever happen to a human being. If you want to have a living hope, you put your hope in something that could be verified and you understand in your mind and inside your heart that what you believe is true, not just because you think it is, but because it legitimately is true. Now, I'm going to finish this very quickly. He says in verse 40, you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. What do we say to people who say it's not fair that God has a hell? What does Jesus say about people like that? They're not what? He doesn't say you're not able. He doesn't say, hey, you're close, you know, just keep trying. He says you're not willing. You don't want to. Christianity is the easiest religion there is. Very simple. This is all we have. This is our only book. You go to any other religion, they have tons of books. They have hundreds of books that you have to read to understand salvation. Christianity only has this little thing. And beyond that, salvation is the simplest thing ever. You put your faith in Jesus Christ and what he did for you on the cross. It's the simplest thing that you could ever have and understand. The reason why people reject Jesus is not because he's too difficult, it's because he's too simple for them. They're not willing. They're not willing. Now he says in verse 41, I do not receive honor from men, but I know that you do not have the love of God in you. I have come in my Father's name, you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, you will receive him. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek honor that comes from God? In other words, they're not submissive. They only seek their own. They don't want to glorify God. Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe in me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how you believe my words? I'm going to end it with this. If you want to have a good Bible study, don't go into the Bible for intellectual reasons. Don't study theology like you study geology. If you want to have a good Bible study, study these things as if Jesus is a real person and you're trying to relate to him. He says, this book is about me. He says, it's about me. It's my biography. If you want to understand Jesus, you've got to be in his word. If you want to understand him, you've got to be thinking about these things, meditating them, mulling them over, understanding them in deeper depth and intimacy. And that's what Jesus calls us to do, and I hope that you guys are doing it. Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word, how it guides us, instructs us, and helps us. Lord, help us to be people who diligently seek you, God, not people who just take it for granted that you've given us all these beautiful words and these beautiful things, God, but that we really study for ourselves, and we know that there is a hope in you. In your name, amen.